From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Are research scientists still using poor black families as guinea pigs? That's one question that's emerged after the Associated Press recently reported that sludge made of human and industrial waste was spread around 9 low-income homes. Scientists were trying to see if the fertilizer could protect children from lead poisoning in the soil. The federally funded research began about 7 years ago. Johns Hopkins University helped conduct the study. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a university dean who says the research was safe, but some scientists and community activists disagree. They say no one is absolutely sure that the sludge wasn't harmful to the communities it was meant to help. Joining me now is John Heilprin. He's a former environmental reporter, and he co-authored the Associated Press story. John, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So as you understand it and as you reported it, what's the basic problem with the study?
Well, at root, the problem that I see is that the material in question that they used, no one can prove that the material is safe. That's the essence of it.
Now, scientists used a fertilizer called Ecology Orgrow Compost. Now, the Kennedy Krieger Institute, a research group that was involved in the study, said it was using a so-called Class A compost, and a Class A rating means that the way that the soil was treated made it safe. What is Class A soil or fertilizer, and what does your investigation suggest about the safety regulations around that?
Well, we've been taking a look at sludge for over a year now, and EPA permits two classes of what's called sewage sludge, or biosolids is the preferred term by the industry, Class A, Class B. The Class B is more commonly used for agricultural products. The Class A, which was used for the study, is more highly treated, and in this case, it is sold at nurseries, hardware stores. As the proponents say, it's used on the White House lawn, or it has been. However, the treatment level is that it's they kill off indicator pathogens like E. coli and Salmonella. They do not kill all the pathogens, and they kill them to detectable levels, which means that there's maybe some left. That's the essence of it.
In a moment, we're going to talk with someone from Johns Hopkins University, but one of the questions that has arisen is the question of consent. You know, when you agree to be part of a study, how do you agree? Do you understand what's going on? What's your understanding of how the people who were approached, the families who were approached, were given information to make a good decision about what they did?
Well, you know, first of all, we tried to find the participants, and nobody would tell us their identities. We had to send a Freedom of Information Act request to Department of Housing and Urban Development to get some documents. The Kennedy Krieger Institute referred all questions to Hopkins. We finally got a few answers from them, but not the participants. So what we were told was that they were given brochures on the dangers of lead contamination, which is a problem in a city like Baltimore with aging housing, and that they were told that the fertilizer was a commercially grade fertilizer sold in the state of Maryland, and that there wasn't any danger to it.
Now, you also spoke with a local environmental activist, Glenn Ross, from East Baltimore, and he had some theories about why the researchers chose this neighborhood for the study. What was his take as you talked to him?
Well, he didn't exactly know. He was actually trying to help us identify the participants, and he drove us around some of the neighborhoods. But, you know, he took us on one of his, quote, toxic tours of Baltimore and showed us various neighborhoods. And in this particular study, he was talking about how, what his quote was that if you want to do something very questionable, you would do it in a neighborhood that's not going to be there in a few years. And he was referring to some of the neighborhoods that are destined for demolition. I think his meaning is that perhaps the participants may no longer be able to be easily found. Certainly, we didn't find any medical follow-up.
When you think about the fact that now the NAACP is calling for an investigation, what is the path that reporters like you, city officials, activist groups need to follow to explore this to the fullest?
Well, what we are interested in, really, and we're continuing to report, is the overall national sludge policy. What we found interesting about this study is that you have researchers backed by government funding operating on the assumption that sludge is good enough to eat. And what we found was that this was indicative, I guess you could say, of a broader policy aimed at promoting and finding broader uses of sewage sludge. There are these different classes, and I understand the arguments back and forth on Class B, Class A, et cetera, but, you know, at root, all of this material that we're talking about in this particular case comes from a wastewater treatment plant in Baltimore. Like every other city, it takes in tens of thousands of organic pollutants, heavy metals, pathogens, PCBs, et cetera. It sends them through processes. This fertilizer we're talking about is a more highly treated form. However, at root, nobody can say on any given day what exactly is in this stuff.
Well, John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Joining me now is Dr. Michael Clagg. He's Dean of the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Dean Clagg, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So the principal investigator in the Baltimore soil study had a joint appointment with the Bloomberg School and the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore. You've agreed to speak with us given that connection to your school. So can you tell me first about why the researchers chose the communities that they did?
Certainly. Well, when this study was done, Baltimore was in an epidemic of lead poisoning. And in the area where this study was done, levels of elevated blood levels in children were 35 to 40 times higher than the national average. So Kennedy Krieger Institute, which treats kids with developmental issues, was seeing about 1,000 kids a year with lead poisoning. Kennedy Krieger Institute was looking at how to prevent this epidemic in the areas that were most affected.
I happen to be from Baltimore. I know there's a tremendous amount of poverty and, you know, the effects of that, including health effects. There's also been a history of bad blood at times between residents of the poorer neighborhoods, which tend to be black, not universally so, but tend to be, and the university, which has wealth and the need for test subjects, frankly. Did you take into account that you might have to be very clear about your mission, your goal, your visions, and your support from the community as you went into a project like this?
Certainly, and you're right. You know, there is a long history of why vulnerable populations might be suspicious of medical research in this country. And so I want to say that, you know, medicine in general, there have been transgressions and there are things that have not been done well, but this study wasn't one of those. Community representatives were involved in a meaningful way in planning of the project and in oversight of the project when it occurred and in overseeing the publication of the results. And then the informed consent process was done by people from the community, by employees who worked in the study but who were from the community.
I want to read you something from a fact sheet that was released by the Kennedy Krieger Institute regarding the study. And it says, the Maryland Department of the Environment and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency regulations require testing of the stabilized compost to ensure it meets quality parameters such as pathogen control, to ensure disease-causing organisms are at a safe level, and heavy metals contained in the compost are below maximum allowable concentrations.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to focus in on one word, which is safe. According to the AP reporter's story, the EPA Inspector General and the National Academy of Sciences have done studies that conclude the following, that the EPA's rules concerning sludge testing are inadequate, and there hasn't been enough conclusive research done to prove that the sludge is not unsafe. So do you feel that although there is at least this basic level of safety that's been met, that really the research supports human testing of these materials in people's backyards?
Let's be clear. The controversy you're referring to refers to sludge, the type B biosolids. This is type A. So this is compost that you can buy at any garden store. The state environmental regulations here are much stricter than the EPA, and this product was far below those standards. So I think one of the issues was there was, with the initial report, is there was a confusion between the type A biosolids and the type B. So the anecdotal reports which have been put out about harm have related to the type B.
Why then do you think this has caused such an uproar? What is it in your mind as this has unfolded that...
Well, I think it was inaccurately portrayed in the press. It was portrayed as putting toxic sludge on the lawns of poor people to experiment on them. And it's just not true. We did not go out and look for homes where there were children and measure, the exposure of children and their blood levels. It wasn't that. It was a technique to amend soil that had been used in a variety of other settings, had been shown in a laboratory to reduce bioavailable lead in the soil, and we wanted to see if you did it in homes, in yards, would it reduce the lead in that soil.
How are you dealing with the fact that at this point the NAACP and other organizations are getting involved? What kind of communications are you having with them, if any?
Well, yeah, certainly. You know, we've reached out and spoken to the director of the Baltimore City NAACP, and he and I are meeting, and I'm meeting with the head of the state NAACP to discuss the concerns and to talk about the study and to go through exactly what occurred during the study with them. Because I think once they understand the situation, that they will understand that this was a study that did not present risk to people in Baltimore, and that it was done in collaboration with the community.
Well, Dean Clagg, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Michael Clagg is Dean of the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. All this month, we've been talking about how housing issues affect African-American communities. But before people dreamed about buying pre-made houses on pre-approved lots, they wanted land. 40 acres, more or less. When the United States was founded, only white land-owning males could vote. And slaves and sharecroppers felt a sense of freedom, pride, and power when they were finally able to purchase and farm their own land. In 1920, the United States had almost 1 million black farmers. Collectively, they owned more than 15 million acres. Now, almost 90 years later, that number has dropped to fewer than 30,000 black farmers who now own less than 2 million acres. Many family farms are in trouble, no matter who owns them, but black farmers are going under at a 5 to 6 times rate of white farmers. In a few moments, we'll check in with two advocates for black farmers, but right now we have Ben Burkett. He owns more than 250 acres of farmland in Petal, Mississippi. He's also a member of the Indian Springs Farming Co-op. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, pleasure to have you on. So how long have you been farming, and how did you get into the business?
I've been farming for 34 years, and I kind of took over from my father. I'm a fourth-generation farmer on the same land for a little over 100 years.
What does it mean to you to have land in your family for this long and to be a farmer in your family over these generations?
Well, it means I always got somewhere to go home. Paid for, the taxes paid up, so it's a social pride to know that my family been farming for a little over 100 years, and I'm the fourth generation. We always been somehow or another able to make a living out of it and carry it on forth to, we hope to leave it to the next generation. I'm 56 years old, so I have a daughter and some great nephews farming with me now, so it's been a real enjoyment that. Just know that you've always got somewhere to go.
So when you talk about, you know, this land and your family, what challenges are you facing right now in terms of maintaining a market for your products and keeping up the land?
The high cost of inputs is the biggest thing now. This diesel is $4. Labor doubled since the hurricane. Katrina, I was in the hurricane, Katrina-affected area. And also the marketing issue. You know, in a small farm, we receive very little subsidy from the federal government, if any. And we don't think that's fair. We think the farm bill ought to reflect those small, medium family farmers that's still out there. Black farmers that's still holding on and struggling. There should be some compensation in the farm bill for those type of farming operation too.
Well, Ben, I'm going to bring in our other two guests. We've got Gary Grant, who's the national president of the Black Farmers and Agriculturalists Association. He's also a landowner in North Carolina and son of a lifelong farmer. And Ralph Page, executive director of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives in Atlanta. Ralph and Gary, welcome.
Hello. Good to be here.
Thanks to have you on. So, Gary, you know Ben personally. You know other farmers with, you know, similar stories and struggles in terms of having to deal with the logistics of keeping a hold of land. So, in your mind, what's been the biggest challenge for black farmers over the years?
Access to capital has been the primary issue, and even when there have been disaster years, like Ben was talking about earlier, you know, how things go up, that they still don't have the access to the capital and even federal programs that should function and work for them and enable them to be able to ascertain what they need in order to recapture and regain control. But overall, access to capital and the fact that the United States Department of Agriculture has pretty much ruined all of the black farmers' credit rating in the United States.
What do you mean when you say the department has ruined people's credit rating? That's a broad sweeping allegation. What do you mean specifically?
Well, the fact that when farmers were going to what was known as the Farmers Home Administration, that farmers were not given adequate financing from or treated the same way that the local white growers were treated. They were faced with discrimination and actually racial acts of discrimination and never received the full amount of money that they needed to operate their farms. They received the money late in the planting year. And all of those pieces play into whether you have a good crop year and whether you are able to make your payments back to the government on time. So as the Farmers Home Administration, which is now known as the Farm Service Agency, was the lender of last resort, if it was going to help to destroy you, it also helped to destroy your credit rating.
Ralph, this is a time when you have a few different trends. You have the rise of agribusiness and, you know, big companies really taking over major levels of farming and seed production and seed distribution. But you also have people trying to plug back in, even, you know, urban people trying to do, you know, gardening, community gardening, farmers markets. What are the good and bad aspects to where a black family farm might find itself today?
Well, I think there's tremendous interest in ownership of land by black community and by black farmers. In fact, the largest wealth that was ever created in this country with 15 million acres of land by African American farmers has been lost. So we have lost a grave asset in the black community and the greatest piece of wealth. We are down now to about 2 million acres of land. And that for a country that talks about freedom and promote freedom, and you just look at the opportunity and what has happened to the land ownership in this country, and it is almost, it's an atrocity that countries richest in America, that a large segment of the population have lost all the land. Saying that, there's tremendous pride in the black community about ownership and about land. There are a lot of young folk who would like to come back if there were opportunities to farming and to own the land and starting value-added processing and doing things to make a living and create economic opportunities in their own community.
Now, let me ask you this. When you know, you're the executive director of something called the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. What are these cooperatives that you are helping to coordinate?
Well, we're working with over 75 credit unions and cooperatives, marketing and production cooperatives throughout the Southeast region. Small groups getting together, collectively creating markets, collectively growing their crops, and doing things that would add value to it and doing things where they can, in fact, stay on the land. And one case, in fact, I'm working on today, a group of farmers in Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, and the Carolinas are going to come together and develop markets and providing technical assistance to these local cooperatives where they can get certified. They can become certified growers. They can have their facilities certified and help them create a brand and markets. And this is the only way that a small farmer is going to compete through cooperatives.
Let me get Ben.
If I can interrupt there, because Ralph probably needs to say something about this as well. And we are still talking about the fact of how do they have access to capital even in this process. And I believe earlier you said that, you know, we're talking about 25,000 black farmers left in this country. And I would challenge that statistic given out by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, because they're talking about people who gross $1,000 a year, but even those growers cannot borrow from the USDA to, you know, to be able to move forward and increase what it, their growing possibilities. So the question really is, what is a family farmer, and at what stage do you declare that it's a family farmer and not throw out statistics that deceive the rest of the country?
Well, let me get Ben back into this. We were just talking a little bit about the co-ops, and you're part of something called the Indian Springs Farming Co-op.
Yes, ma'am.
What is it that you do? I mean, when you grow a crop, and tell me, give me an example of what crop you grow, how does the co-op assist you in getting that to market?
Yes, this co-op is a little over 30 years old. At the present time, we have 34 members. We had over 40 members before the hurricane, so after Katrina, our members decided not to go. But this facility is a place where we bring out produce, and we repack it, and we ship it out. We have about, right now, we have over 5 pallets of strawberries going to be shipped out of here tonight. And in this facility, which the Federation helped us on the construction of it, and the state of Mississippi and a little federal money. The bill is about 10 years old. But the cooperative is the only reason why many of us have been able to survive. So we got a place that meets USDA standards with all the certificates for processing vegetables. And we can repack it, cut it, put it in the bag or whatever, and ship it out. And it's been a godsend to this community. Yep. Many farmers and vendors.
Ralph, what's the future? I mean, you gave some hints about how black farmers can find a niche, particularly black family farms. But to my knowledge, there are no African-American-owned agribusinesses, like major companies. Is that your understanding?
Well, there may be one or two that, you know, of scale to the large multimillion-dollar operations, they're minuscule. Now, seeing that, you know, our goal is to start we are starting and working with small cooperatives owned by small farmers like Indian Spring. There are groups in Georgia, which is value-added, we call it, value-added, where a small group of farmers get together, in this case, they grow and harvest and process collard greens and put them on the market and create a brand. There's another co-op that does Southern Alternatives pecans, where small farmers collectively grow, harvest, produce, crack, shell, and ship pecans. They're doing a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. And there are examples like that all over the place. But here again, going back to the whole idea, there's not capital. It's not easy accessible from the banks. It's not easy accessible at all, if any, from USDA and the various programs. There's a farm bill that would speak to this if enough resources would get into programs like that. There are several USDA programs, which are co-op center grants, money to provide technical support for farmers that want to do this. There's a training program, which they call a technical assistance program, 2501, that has never had enough funds to really address this. So there are two or three things going on here.
Let me go back a little bit in time.
Support.
Let me go back a little bit in time to the Pigford versus Glickman case. It was one of these landmark cases for black farmers. And Gary, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Pigford case was brought about because of the very things that Ralph and Ben and I have been talking about, the fact that people were discriminated, black farmers were discriminated against in governmental programs, not only the lending programs, but the delivery of other programs that were supposed to be able to assist them. And the case was filed in 1998, and a settlement, so-called settlement, was reached in 1999, where people could, farmers could take a track A or track B. And if they took track A, they would settle for $50,000. And hopefully, if they had debt, that it would be written off, and hopefully that they could save their farmland. Track B required that you have, you could go after larger sums, but you also had to have a larger amount of proof in order to prove your case. This was something that we still today say that the attorney who represented us entered into that agreement with the and somewhat forced the seven lead plaintiffs to settle for this, which denied many black farmers real settlement to their cases. I mean, you lose 300 acres of land, you lose your way of living, and you end up with $50,000, and lo and behold, you receive a tax statement from your state for something that you didn't even know that you were going to get. And in many cases, people didn't have ample money left when the state tax piece came through to pay it. So it actually got more people into trouble, and farmers-wise, and there are farmers 10 years now who entered in 1998 that are still trying to get settlement out of the government.
Ben, you were one of the farmers in the class action, civil action lawsuit. And what was your approach to it? What did you get out of it, good or bad?
It was. I don't think it was structured right. I agree with Gravy's so-called lawsuit. I filed it on the A in 1999, and I had to go through two appeals before I was approved, and I'm waiting to receive my $50,000. But it appeared the way it was designed, any black farmer that would continue to farm or was farming, it was always difficult for them type farmers to qualify. And I know all my neighbors that's black are still farming it. 8 years later, and they still hadn't received the $50,000, although it's been in the process of continuing to work. So it was out there, but it didn't do near as good as we thought it should have did.
You know, and all the farmers who went through this, they have not been made whole. Their credit has not been restored where it should have
right.
been. They have not been able to go back to farming. Then, of course, they lose the land anyway. $50,000 is not enough to really redress the problems that they have experienced and with discrimination. Now, the other thing that I hope for personally, that this will once and for all stop any discrimination as we know it at USDA, other agencies, and really bring this to this issue to the forefront in this country. And yet we're still losing land. There's no action taken against it. And these practices still goes on at the department. And so I don't know if this thing, when you really uncover all the benefits, how good was it? You know, then now in this, even hung up in this farm bill, is legislation that give people who were left out. There are many farmers that were left out of it.
Now, gentlemen, I'm going to break in here. I want each of you to give me, literally, a word to a sentence, why it's important or what you love about having black-owned farms. I mean, I think sometimes people think farming is a tough life. Who would want it anyway? Mm-hmm. Ben, what's good about it?
What's good about it? Any country that can't not able to feed itself is in a world of trouble. We're beginning to see that effect now.
All right.
You need that diversity of production.
Ralph.
You know, pluralistic ownership in a country like America is the most important thing, an example that a country can set where blacks, white, people of color can own a part of this place that we call ours.
Gary?
There are people who enjoy working in the soil and the solace that it brings and to them, as well as the quality of life that it brings to them.
All right, gentlemen, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Ben Burkett from Petal, Mississippi, Ralph Page, Executive Director of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives in Atlanta, Gary Grant, National President of the Black Farmers and Agricultural Association. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's time to take a look at the world of sports. With us today is Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai.
So it's basketball season, but football is in the news this week.
Well,
right?
You know, that's right, because the NFL draft is starting Saturday, and because of Adam Pac-Man Jones. The Tennessee Titans are washing their hands of the controversial cornerback, who's been arrested 6 times, by the way, and are trading him to the Dallas Cowboys. Oh, and did I mention he's currently on suspension by the league? Everybody is talking about this deal, and that includes our Sports Bloggers Roundtable. Joining me today are Marcus Vandenberg, a senior producer at BET.com and author of the sports blog Play a Hater, and Terrence Harris, sports writer and blogger for the Houston Chronicle. Hello, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing great, thank you. As we said, Pac-Man is going to do Dallas if the commissioner lets him back in the league. If you're wondering why this is interesting to followers of the NFL, consider this. Jones was involved in an incident outside a strip club in Las Vegas during last year's NBA All-Star weekend. Now, police are saying that Jones paid a guy $15,000 in connection with that incident, in which a club employee was shot, by the way. Jones pled no contest to charges of disorderly conduct, and that comes on top of several other run-ins with the law that the 24-year-old cornerback has had in the last 3 years. So he was suspended by the league, still is, and now comes this trade. That's the backstory. So, Marcus, today a lot of teams see him as more trouble than he's worth, but apparently that does not include the Dallas Cowboys, who gave up a 4th-round draft pick to get him. Should Pac-Man be allowed to come back to the league?
I think Pac-Man should have one last chance. You know, we're founded on this country as giving people second, third chances, and he did his time. He sat out for a year, so I think he should have one last chance. But if he slips up one time while in Dallas, I think that should be it. I think Roger Goodell will drop the hammer on him, and that'll be it for Pac-Man.
Well, let me ask you, Terrence, is this a good deal for Dallas if the league does, in fact, reinstate Pac-Man and the trade goes through?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, this guy is, for all of the problems he may cause, I mean, he also offers something that you just can't find very often in the NFL or anywhere, and that's a shutdown corner. I mean, and those are valuable. And so, no, I think that, you know, Pac-Man Jones, this was a great investment by Jerry Jones to pick him up. I mean, and right now all you're giving up is a 4th-round draft pick, and it only gets more expensive if the guy shows up and actually does what he's supposed to do. Otherwise, all you've really given up is a 4th-round pick who may or may not really make your team and certainly won't make an impact. You know, so this was a great, great business move on the part of the Dallas Cowboys, and I have a feeling that Pac-Man Jones probably realizes that, you know, that, hey, this is the end of the line, and I got to do things right this time or else I'm out.
We'll see, won't we?
Yeah.
Let's move on to the NFL draft beginning on Saturday. Now, the Miami Dolphins say that they've come to an agreement with Michigan offensive lineman Jake Long, who will be the #1 pick. But the draft is scheduled to officially begin on Saturday. So, Marcus, does this early signing kill any intrigue that the draft may have had in the past?
No, I don't think so. We've seen this before with teams negotiating deals with players. You know, the draft has become such an event, thanks to ESPN, that I think, you know, knowing the Dolphins are taking Jake Long won't take any suspense out of the draft. I'm looking forward to where Darren McFadden lands up. You know, he could either go to the Raiders at the 4th pick, or he could actually fall down to the 6th pick of the New York Jets. So I think there's a lot of storylines still dealing with the 1st round of the NFL draft on Saturday.
Well, you know, every year, Terrence, the argument is whether a team, and I know you've heard this, whether a team should draft by position need or take, quote, the best athlete available. Is that really true, though? And what do teams want most in a player?
Well, I mean, I think you do. You need, I mean, you have to draft, I think, by need, you know, more so than anything. But a lot of times, like, when you're picking #1, that probably means you probably pretty much need everything. So, you know, you can't go wrong. I mean, like the Dolphins, you know, going with Jake Long, I mean, you know, prototype type left tackle. I mean, those franchise left tackle, those aren't exactly grown trees. So, you know, when you have an opportunity to take a guy like him, you do. And I think, you know, when you look out over, you know, the overall talent, I mean, there's a lot of great talent coming out this year. But, I mean, I don't think that you look at any of those guys and you say, man, I can't get another quarterback in a couple of years, because those quarterbacks are coming. I mean, the quarterbacks that are coming out this year aren't necessarily that special. You look at McFadden. McFadden is, you know, he's done great, but I mean, we don't know, you know, if he'll be a franchise type running back or not. I mean, if you look at the history of top running college running backs who come into the NFL, a lot of times those just don't really work out. It's a crapshoot. This left tackle business, I mean, that was a smart move on their part. I like that move. But, you know, you have to draft, by need.
By need. All right, we'll see what happened. What's going to happen. It also seems that there is some interest in drafting good citizens now, if you can. But more so, they want you to be able to play than to be a good citizen. That's the way it seems to be going. But let's move on to the NBA, because a lot's going on there. A busy week for the NBA this week. First round of playoffs in full effect. And already we have seen some nasty play, like in the Cleveland Cavaliers-Washington Wizards series. And one argument, Marcus, that always comes up, and it has again this week, is whether the league wants certain teams to keep playing and whether certain superstars get protected by the refereeing. Of course, I'm referring to the flagrant foul on LeBron James by the Wizards' Brendan Haywood. James wasn't hurt, although he could have been, and Haywood was ejected. And then he said in his defense, come on, this is the playoffs, and no one was trying to hurt James. Haywood wasn't suspended, but should he have been?
No, I don't think so. And actually, on that play, I think Brendan Haywood should have done that a lot earlier. You know, you have LeBron James just driving down the paint at will. One of your guys has to step up and say, hey, LeBron, it's not going to happen. You need to lay down a hard foul. It's part of the playoffs. You know, I think that the non-suspension, I don't think Brendan was actually trying to hurt LeBron. But I also think that, you know, it's something that should have been earlier, and no suspension is fine on this part.
Well, you know, Terrence, a lot of clubs are up 2-0 in the first round, but that could be attributed to holding home court advantage. We'll see as we go into game threes. Or are we going to see a bunch of four-game sweeps in round one of this year's playoffs, do you think?
I think in a couple of situations, you're probably looking at four-game sweeps. I mean, I think right now you look at how, you know, Utah's playing against the Rockets. I mean, I think that, you know, they took two games on the Rockets' home court, so now they get to go home, you know, for two games. And so you have to think that that's probably, you know, a series that's definitely, you know, set up for a sweep in the wrong direction. Then you look at, you look at how the Lakers are playing right now with Kobe, and after what Kobe did last night, I mean, and you have to feel like the momentum is there for them. I mean, Boston and Atlanta, you have to feel like, I mean, that's one of those. I mean, I still have not a great feel for the Cleveland Wizards series, although, I mean, I'm a guy who's from Cleveland, so therefore I think that Haywood should be suspended. I thought that was an unnecessary foul. I think there's a right way and a wrong way to play basketball, so I disagree a little bit on that. Should have happened earlier. It should not have happened.
Is that because you're from Cleveland?
No, you don't play basketball that way. I'm sorry. I mean, you know, there's a right and a wrong way, and leveling hard fouls is not, you know, that's not how you play basketball.
Well, it certainly is the way the NBA has been played as long as I've been watching it,
yeah, but
particularly during the playoff time.
Yeah, no, that's not how you play basketball. I mean, that was wrong, and he did. He went after LeBron, I mean, in a way where he was trying to hurt the guy. It was just fortunate that he didn't get hurt. And, you know, and that, once again, I don't think you go out to try to hurt people. I mean, you do try to defend your lane and defend your area, and, you know, and not let people just attack the basketball or attack the basket, but there's a right and a wrong way to do things. But, no, I think that also may be a series where, you know, you look at it and you could say, you know, the Wizards could get swept, especially after the way that last game ended.
Absolutely. Let's talk about this for a minute, guys, because it keeps coming up year after year after year. It's one of those conspiracy kind of theories that will never probably be completely resolved or will ever go away entirely. But here's the question. Marcus, do you think that the league, the NBA, is, wink, wink, angling for a Lakers-Celtics final?
No, I think everyone in the NBA is hoping for a Celtics-Lakers finals. I don't think their actions on the courts in terms of the referees are going to impact that outcome. You know, I don't think the NBA really wants to see Detroit, San Antonio in the finals. I think the ratings will take a huge dip if that happens. So, you know, as sports fans, we also want to see the best matchup. So as fans, we actually, you know, we were rooting for the Lakers and Celtics, I would think, for the best matchup. So, no, I don't think the NBA has any outcome on the final situation on the court.
You agree with that?
I wholeheartedly agree with that. I mean, I think that that, you know, Boston and the Lakers will probably end up in the finals because they're the two best teams. How about that one?
That's a good argument.
They're the two best teams with the most talented teams out there right now. So I think that's why we're going to see them in the finals, not because of some conspiracy theory. I mean, referees, I mean, they may influence calls here or there, but they can't really influence an entire series. The better team is going to win. I mean, you know, it's always going to prevail. Believe that.
All right, let's talk about Isaiah Thomas and the New York Knicks. The Knicks finally dropped the axe on him after months of speculation. Two axes, actually. First from his front office job and then from his coaching spot. Two things. First to you, Marcus. Who should replace him as the coach? You know, the speculation that GM Donnie Walsh may hire former Knick Mark Jackson or maybe even Herb Williams. Jeff Van Gundy has already said no thanks. Scott Skiles has gone to the Bucks. So what's left?
I would go with Mark Jackson at this point. They have nothing to lose. The Knicks franchise is a complete mess. You at least be bringing back a former Knicks player, a guy that the players respect, a fan favorite in New York, and give him opportunity to sort of turn this team around. You really can't get any worse. So why not bring a young face back into the NBA coaching game and hire Mark Jackson?
So, Terrence, what happens to Isaiah, though? That's my question for you. I mean, is he head coaching material for another team? Is he through in the NBA? I mean, he has been ordered to stay away from Knicks players. That's pretty cold, isn't it?
I mean, Isaiah Thomas needs to go away, period. You know, my question is, why did it take so long? I mean, the guy, after the whole, you know, sexual harassment, you know, debacle, you know, this past summer and how that played out. I mean, and the things that went on there, that in itself just told me that this guy really doesn't get it, you know, and that, you know, maybe, you know, we want to remember Isaiah as a great player. He's just tarnishing that memory, that image with every step he's made, you know, since he left playing pro basketball. Every professional step he's made since then has just been, you know, it's been a huge failure in this situation. I mean, he's decimated this franchise. I mean,
well, Terrence, how do you really feel about Isaiah Thomas?
I mean, I'm just saying, guys, this dude is terrible. I mean, he's terrible for basketball. He should just go away. He has, you know, plenty of money in the bank and enjoy his life, and we won't have to deal with him. I mean, and as far as who they need a magician to come in there to reverse what's going on here in the last 7 years. They have not won. They've had seven straight losing seasons. He got this team stocked. Now, all of that isn't on Isaiah, of course, but this team right now is stocked with a bunch of guys who aren't really worth a whole lot. I mean, he's taking everybody's bad trade.
Well, let me interrupt you to end with this. We have 10 seconds. Your MVP, Marcus, in the NBA MVP.
Kobe Bryant.
Terrence.
I'm gonna give it to Chris Paul.
Chris Paul. All right, we won't have to wait long to find out. Thank you, guys. Joining us today, Marcus Vandenberg, a senior producer at BET.com, author of the sports blog Play a Hater. He joined us from New York City. Terrence Harris, sports writer and blogger for the Houston Chronicle.
That was NPR's Tony Cox. And now, time for our letters. Joining me to dig through the mailbag is our producer and editor, Christopher Johnson. Hey, Christopher.
Hey, Farah. How you feeling?
Ready for the weekend. Oh, wait. That's not till tomorrow. Anyway, what's up first?
Well, last week, you know, Pope Benedict's visit to the States got wall-to-wall press coverage. And even though the pontiff wasn't really the topic of conversation in the bloggers' roundtable last week, blogger Michael Fisher managed to work the Pope in. Fisher was pointing out discrepancies he sees between criticisms pointed at Reverend Jeremiah Wright and the reverence handed to the Pope.
In the previous segment, it was just mentioned how miraculous it was that Pope Benedict came over here and what great reception he got. Now, this man is a former Nazi who was part of a Nazi regime that actually killed millions of Jews, an active member of the Nazi party.
Well, Farai, you can probably guess what came next, an avalanche of emails, some disappointed, others downright nasty. Here's a pretty even-tempered note we got from Dana Franchito in South Wellfleet, Massachusetts. I understand that the Pope, as a young man, was a member of the Hitler Youth because he didn't have a choice. but there's no known record of his having been an active, willing member of the Nazi Party. We must be fair in these matters.
Dana, thanks for your note, and you are absolutely right. Pope Benedict has spoken pretty openly about growing up in Nazi Germany and joining the fascist youth corps because of a government requirement for high school students. He also served in an anti-aircraft unit that guarded a BMW plant near Munich, but he was not a member of the Nazi Party. And moving on to another topic, also from our bloggers' roundtable, we discussed former HUD Secretary Alfonso Jackson, who left office last Friday. Now, Jackson is under investigation for possibly enriching himself and his friends with lucrative government contracts. Peter Wissaker in Ithaca, New York, heard that conversation and sent us this. Today, I just had to write because your blogger's discussion of the investigation of Alfonso Jackson neglected his most famous comment, one I would argue probably invited more scrutiny from the media than the color of his skin. In 1996, he was quoted as saying, "Why should I reward someone who doesn't like the president? So they can use funds to try to campaign against the president? Logic says they don't get the contract. That's the way I believe." This kind of partisanship did not sit well with many people and marked him as exactly the kind of person one did not want running HUD.
And finally, William Withers in Arlington, Texas, sent us this short but tough note. Withers writes, "I listen to NPR every day, but I'm forced to change the channel when your show comes on. As a white middle-class American, I'm tired of hearing all the segregation on your show. By no stretch am I racist, but it's called News and Notes, not Black News and Notes. Change the name if that's what it's going to be."
Hey, William, we get letters like yours from time to time, and I will give the same response we always do. Our mission is, and I'm quoting here because we have it up on a big poster board, to illuminate the diversity of the African-American experience. As we do that, we hope to shine light on other folks' experiences as well. But the bottom line is, this is Black News and Notes. But everyone's welcome to listen.
And that's it for Black News and Notes letters, but please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to NPR.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Christopher, many, many thanks.
Farai, anytime.
Black like the planet that they fear. Why they scared? Black like the slave ship gully that brought us here. Black like the cheeks that are rolled.
And that was the voice of Christopher Johnson, who is leaving us today for freelance climbs. We will miss you and bon viage. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.